Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. The fast food empire we know as McDonald's started as a burger stand in San Bernardino. And then Ray Kroc came along with the idea of franchising.
In the earliest days of McDonald's, they didn't sell you the food. They sold you a blueprint for how to run the restaurant and how to order the food. And yes, it was laid out in this manual, step by step, from everything to how many nickels to have in the cash register, to how many potatoes to order every week, to how often the bathrooms needed to be cleaned.
Later in the show, Lisa Napoli explains how the post-World War II building boom of freeways and suburbs gave rise to fast food. We start today's show in Las Vegas, where the new year kicks off with CES, or the Consumer Electronics Show. That's the mega trade show and conference where the latest tech gadgets are unveiled. Lindsay Turrentine is editor-in-chief of CNET Reviews, and she joins us to tell us what to expect. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, how are you?
So it's incredible to believe that CES celebrates its 50th anniversary. One, who knew that it was that old? And two, being that old, is it still relevant?
Well, it's kind of funny, isn't it? I mean, we tend to think of CES as this very future-centered show, and so it's a little bit hard to think about it in this 50-year-old context. And as companies like Apple and Google have their own giant events to announce their biggest products, we find that CES is becoming essentially a giant meeting place. It's a place where people come from all over the world to sit and have this conversation about technology and where it's going and what the challenges in the way of technology are and what policy needs to change, and simply just sit around and imagine what's going to happen, in addition to hearing some really cool announcements.
So you're saying that the conference piece of it is really important, the talking.
All through town, there are meetings happening at the Venetian and at the Wynn and at the Cosmopolitan, people sitting down in rooms and just having that meeting that they're not going to get on the books any other time because everybody's in the same place at the same time.
And I think one should just remind any listeners that might not have attended CES, there is something so incredibly strange about being surrounded by all these companies with their futuristic gadgets, and you're in the Venetian, which is this faux Venice.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the thing about Vegas is that it's adult Disneyland. It's a place where you don't expect anything to be realistic, so it's just as easy to look at fake Venice as it is to look at, you know, virtual reality on a headset. It actually kind of makes sense when you're there.
Ah, you've launched us straight into one of our questions that we wanted to put to you, which is that at last year's CES, as in 2016, everyone was talking about VR, if they weren't talking about the Internet of Things. Are people still talking about VR?
I think that everyone will talk about VR for many years to come. I mean, virtual reality is something that will happen for most people. But we're in this sort of in-between place where all of the thinking and imagining about what could be has happened. It takes a really long time to make that a reality, so to speak. And we're going to be seeing more headsets. We will absolutely be hearing about augmented reality, which is something that you can think of as like Pokemon Go writ large. You'll be hearing a lot about augmented reality at the show. I think there'll be plenty to talk about. It's going to be a slow evolution now and not so much of a giant new idea.
Okay, so the first CES took place in New York City back in June 1967. Since then, there have been some world-changing products that have been launched there. They include the VCR, the compact disc player, the tablet net, and Android devices. In recent years, it's showcased advances in wearable technology. You just talked about virtual reality and driverless cars. Do you expect any big news out of this year's CES?
It's going to be, I think, the year of the smart home. You mentioned IoT earlier. IoT, or Internet of Things, is this idea that technology products are talking to each other over the Internet, sometimes making decisions or doing things without your participation. That's writ large. Writ small, that technology we like to call smart home technology often, because for you and for me and for consumers, that kind of Internet of Things shows up in a microcosm in your own house. And I think that that's going to be huge at this show. I think you're going to be hearing really interesting announcements between companies participating. So think about ways in which your car can work with your house, and your house can work with your security system, and ways in which we can figure out and understand and affect what's going on in our homes, maybe even when we're not in them. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about that topic at the show. And this year, CES overlaps by a day with the Detroit Auto Show, which is the biggest North American auto show. And I think that excitement around cars and this big moment to talk about cars is going to drive a lot of interesting conversations at CES.
And what about Faraday Future? Last year, everybody went to CES thinking they were going to see some kind of Faraday car and realized there was nothing, there was no there. But this year, supposedly, there's going to be a production model.
That's what we hear. Faraday Future is a Tesla competitor, so it says. Faraday Future has a lot to prove because there was some disappointment about this announcement last year. We're excited to see what they have to offer for sure. It's a supercar. It's supposed to be super exciting and hot and probably not something that most people can go out and buy, but might get people's imaginations really spinning.
Now, how much do you think participants at CES will be talking about politics? This is a few weeks before the inauguration of President-elect Trump, and he's lined up a cabinet that is seen to be anti-climate change, pro-oil. They want to stimulate job growth, but through cutting taxes and regulations. What does this all mean for the future of clean technology, of subsidized green energy-efficient cars, and so on?
Well, I think that that remains to be seen. We do know that the technology industry as a whole was generally anti-Trump leading into this, which is sort of interesting when you think about it. This president-elect who's a business leader, in theory, paired against business. And I think that in the end, as always, we will see pressure from the markets drive progress. The question is, will that pressure have any sort of gating factor by the government or will be encouraged by the government? I feel like it's really too early to say. We have a lot more to learn about how Trump is going to deal with technology generally.
And lastly, earlier on in our conversation, you remarked that sometimes the biggest surprises come from the smallest companies. And given the massiveness of CES, one does wonder how the little companies, you know, get noticed when you have Samsung having an absolutely giant amount of space, and ditto for Apple, ditto for all the big companies. You know all the startups. You've talked to many of them over the years. How do they get their voice out there?
Well, I will say that it's, for starters, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to get attention at the show. But now that a lot of major manufacturers are saving their announcements for other times, other parts of the calendar, and maybe not making their biggest annual announcements at CES, there is a little bit more of an opportunity for these small players to get noticed because the press is there in force. CNET will be sending 91 various types of journalists, for instance. We are dying to see things that are new and interesting. For small companies, if a small company is releasing something that we truly have never seen before, a couple years ago, we saw a smart fork with haptic feedback that actually vibrates to tell you to slow down or speed up so you can deal with weight issues and learn to change your eating patterns based on things that the fork is telling you. That got a ton of attention from us and from the press because it was just such an interesting idea. Tiny company, a lot of emotional impact. So I think that the answer is make something we've never seen. Take it to CES. Make sure you get it in the hands of a reporter and watch it grow.
That's Lindsay Tarrantine, Editor-in-Chief of CNET Reviews. As Lindsay said, CES is just massive. So how does a small startup company get heard above the noise?
So my name is Evan Bierenbaum. I'm one of the co-founders of a company called Chai Energy. We're a free mobile app that's empowering customers to save energy and make better energy choices in their home. And we are headed to CES.
And why does it matter to you to have a presence there?
Yeah, I think as a startup going to CES, you get a lot of exposure from outside parties, everything from magazine editors to trade journalists to investors, as well as other inspiring startups are there.
Do you get the choice of what place on the show floor you get?
From looking at other shows and being at other shows, we did find that groups of companies in the same vertical were kind of clustered together. And so I think it makes it really easy for attendees to explore the show when companies are together and the innovations that are very similar are all in the same space.
Are you thinking very kind of carefully and strategically about how to do your display, how to just get attention?
Yes, the booth design is 9/10 of the challenge at CES. You're only given so much space to work with, and you really want to maximize that space so that you can, really, I guess, kind of show well as a business. And I think with CES, you know, you always try to think about or imagine what other people might be doing at the show and almost replicate some of that so that you can almost fit in with the presence there.
But if I'm a journalist that's walking past your booth, how are you going to attract me? Well, are you going to use colors? Are you going to use, you know, interesting typography? Are you going to use VR? How are you going to lure me in?
I think for us, it's the value proposition of Chai, a free mobile app that will pay you to save energy.
But to get me to come in and have that conversation, how do you attract? I'm just talking about the basics of attracting an audience.
Oh yeah. So hopefully it's our innovative video and wonderful booth attendees that'll help draw you in.
Okay, we've just come off of the holidays. Did you get a holiday or were you just too busy preparing for CES?
So as a startup, we're always working. You never really get a break. We are working 150% through the holidays. And it's labor of love.
Well, good luck at CES.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
That's Evan Birnbaum with the LA-based startup company Chai Energy. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, we may now connect fast food with obesity, service wages, and waste. But there was a time when it was a clever response to the new car culture. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Fast food is such a part of our lives, we forget that someone invented it and all the architecture and packaging and other paraphernalia that goes along with it. Now a book is out and a movie comes out this month that tell the story of McDonald's, the people behind it, and the design thinking that went into everything from the logo to the packaging and, of course, the arches.
I know what you're thinking. How the heck does a 52-year-old, over-the-hill milkshake machine salesman build a fast food empire with 1,600 restaurants and an annual revenue of $700 million? One word. Persistence.
The movie The Founder, starring Michael Keaton, depicts the relationship between the brothers Dick and Mac McDonald and Ray Kroc. He's the marketing genius who wound up becoming a multimillionaire on the back of the brothers' invention. The book is by Lisa Napoli. She's a longtime public radio reporter who also worked at this station. It's called Ray and Joan, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away. You may recall that on her death in 2003, Joan Kroc left over $200 million to NPR. Anyway, along the way, Lisa tells the story of how post-war America gave rise to fast food culture.
We are standing at the base of a 26-foot-tall mushroom cloud made of chain link and other things.
And why did you bring us here?
Well, I came here almost 5 years ago with Avishai, your fabulous producer, and we were here covering the fate of this sculpture, which was in disrepair. And there was a hue and cry that the city was going to deaccession this piece rather than retrofit it. And Jerry Rubin, the peace activist, met us here, and he said that he thought it was Joan Kroc who had given the money to build this in the first place. It's a fascinating tale how she evolved and emerged as this major philanthropist after Ray died in 1984. And one of the things that happened was that she became very close friends with Paul Conrad. He was a ferocious peace activist and invited him on a yacht trip up to Alaska. He sketched out for Joan this 26-foot-tall work in cartoon form and said, if you give me the money, I'll build this. So that's how she became involved with this particular work. And at the same time, she was doing major funding of peace conferences and buying ads and newspapers to decry nuclear arms and really coming into her own as a philanthropist.
And this is all when she's a widow of Ray Kroc. Yes. Ray Kroc would have turned in his grave yes. over this kind of activism.
Yes, he would have. He was a God and country kind of very classic conservative businessman who himself had funded Nixon and just didn't really cotton well to the idea of challenging authority, especially his.
And for you, so such an ironic turn of events, given where that money was originally sourced, hamburgers, a hamburger empire created by an incredibly conservative guy whose wife turns out to be unexpectedly maverick.
Yes. Yeah, and it's so interesting because I've spent the last five years learning about Joan, but at a certain moment I realized I couldn't write about Joan without writing about Ray, and I couldn't write about Ray without learning and writing about McDonald's, which really turns out to be an interesting story rooted largely here in Southern California, in the emerging landscape of Southern California in the post-World War II years as roads and suburbs were being developed. That's when hamburger stands and other kinds of food stands developed.
Okay, you've taken us straight to what I wanted to talk about. I found the book so interesting in terms of the story it tells about post-war American development, in terms of the architecture, the infrastructure, the technologies. Let's talk about that, but start by telling us quickly about the two guys that in San Burdu that kicked the whole thing off.
It's amazing, and thank you. I'm so glad you're enjoying the book. What's so incredible is that these two brothers came from New Hampshire at the dawn of the movie industry. Now millions of people come here every year, right? But these guys came out here because they wanted to get in on the game of film before there was even sound in
and
film.
Dick and Mac McDonald.
Yep. Dick and Mac McDonald came out here and they wound up hauling sets, so it wasn't very glamorous. And so in search of more entrepreneurial work, they moved to Glendora, bought a movie theater, ultimately opened a hot dog stand, because that hot dog and orange juice stands were something that were very common in the early emerging roadsides of Southern California, because people were driving, there was no air conditioning, and they needed a drink and a quick, easy snack. So they started one of those. Then they expanded and added ribs and hamburgers and fries. And then they expanded again and moved their shack, basically an octagonal structure, out to San Burdu because that was a very busy place of commerce then. And it grew and grew. And finally, one day they decided, as more and more hamburger stands were opening, that theirs needed to be a little bit more efficient. This was the time of car hops, where people served you to the window. People were so in love with their cars, they didn't want to get out of them when they ate. But Dick and Mac recognized that if they sped up the process of serving you your hamburger and your fry and your milkshake, that they could serve more people. And so that's what they did. They shut down and they retrofitted their restaurant and came up with this efficient blueprint for serving food, almost like a ballet in the little space that they had. And they were onto something, so much so that people came from all around the country to watch and mimic their little choreography of food.
Which they called the Speedy system, is that right?
Yes. The Speedy service system, and they came up with this adorable little, nobody really knew what it was, little pie-shaped guy. But what I found so exciting about learning about Speedy and hamburgers is we take food on the go so for granted, and we take McDonald's and fast food so for granted, even though we don't necessarily love it. But this was a time where that wasn't something that should be taken for granted. It was something that was so exciting because the idea of being mobile in the car, of having more space living out in the suburbs, and then being able to get food delivered to your car or just out, because people didn't eat out that much then. It was just a very interesting landscape, literally and figuratively, in American history.
And then you have this guy, Ray Kroc, who's a kind of a really just a born salesman, very pushy, but also having lots of business ideas, and many of them don't succeed. And he, from afar, reads about this San Badou phenomenon. He goes out there. Now, he himself is part of the kind of changing technology of consumption. What's he selling?
I loved this about Ray. He was selling multi-spindled milkshake machine mixers, and the brothers ordered a number of them, which blew Ray away because he couldn't understand, you know, you could make six milkshakes at a time, but why would they need to make 36 milkshakes at a time? And so he wanted to go out and see this for himself, because even though this was his stock and trade, this was a phenomenon. And so he did. He flew to LA from Chicago and then drove out Route 66 to San Berdu and saw the McDonald's operation in full flush, and was so in love with this incredibly efficient and clean system that the brothers had developed that he begged them to let him franchise it, because he figured if he could franchise it, that he'd sell way more milkshake machine mixers.
But then he does wind up making this deal with the brothers. Ultimately, he becomes the sort of the name of the company. And along the way, he becomes like a completely fanatical seller of these franchises. And also, he takes the basic ideas these brothers have had, and he takes them to this whole level of obsession with detail. Yes. Talk about that.
Yes. Well, he was a very fastidious person, which was a good sales thing then, because a lot of these places weren't so clean. What's interesting is, in the earliest days of McDonald's, they didn't sell you the food. They sold you a blueprint for how to run the restaurant and how to order the food. And yes, it was laid out in this manual, step by step, from everything to how many nickels to have in the cash register, to how many potatoes to order every week, to how often the bathrooms needed to be cleaned, and exactly how to be cleaned. And that was the hallmark of the McDonald's speedy system.
So in a way, it was kind of Fordism being applied to the delivery of food.
Yes, he actually even called it that. He said, I'm putting the hamburger on the assembly line, although it wasn't Ray who put the hamburger on the assembly line. It was Dick and Mac McDonald who came up with that system.
So arches, I mean, you can't talk about the visuals around McDonald's without talking about the arches.
Yes, the arches are significant still to this day. It was Dick McDonald who came up with the idea, when they were starting to retrofit their business, of this fabulous arches that held up this hamburger stand and made it really stand out. And of course, that's what distinguished McDonald's from so many other places, even though, to be fair, many other hamburger places at the time were looking at this Googie style architecture to make it look like something fabulous as you drove down the road and catch your eye. Basically, the building functioned as a sign. And Ray fell in love with that, as well as everything else about McDonald's.
You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton, and I'm talking with Lisa Napoli about her new book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Her story starts in the early days of car culture, when fast food is the new thing. The meat and potatoes are fresh, and McDonald's is not yet associated with poor diet, poor service wages, and mountains of waste packaging. It's a time when McDonald's is a chaste alternative to car hops, before sex is used to sell burgers, and a takeout tycoon can be nominated for a cabinet position.
I don't think there's anything wrong with a beautiful woman in a bikini eating a burger and washing a Bentley or a pickup truck or being in a hot tub. I think there's probably nothing more American.
That's Andrew Puzder. He's the head of the Carl's Jr. and Hardee's fast food chains, and he's President-elect Trump's choice for Labor Secretary. Back to the book. This is a time when people are still astonished that burgers can make someone a multimillionaire, able to live like royalty in a palatial Santa Barbara estate. Here's Lisa Napoli.
In 1965, when McDonald's went public and Ray became an instant multimillionaire, he was on vacation with his second wife, who he'd married in order to sort of bide time until Joan might be ready, and fell in love with the Santa Ynez Valley, who wouldn't, and saw an ad for a 200-acre property that was for sale for $600,000, and he called his lawyer and told him to just buy it. Don't negotiate, just buy it. I want this land. And he instantly incorporated a foundation, which he headquartered on the land as a tax dodge, and then decided to build out an inn, not just to service this foundation, but also just as a rumpus room for he and his friends in the McDonald's universe, and of course, his second wife. And once he divorced his second wife and married Joan, by the fireplace in this fabulous ranch that he called the J&R Double Arch Ranch. And conveniently, the second wife had a J. She was Jane, and there was Joan.
This estate that he creates does not look like your regular McDonald's in any way.
It's the counter to McDonald's, and it was this palatial, beautiful inn, basically, on these 200 acres with all sorts of trappings, but very, very 60s, 70s decor, very gold, shag rugs, massive. I think it was a 20-foot sofa. Elegant ranch, I think, is what they called it in the Architectural Digest feature that they did in 1968 about this house.
But the fact is, you have magazines like Architectural Digest now coming to look at the home of this guy who has made his millions on fast food, that prior to that, editors at a magazine like Architectural Digest would have been extremely sniffy about.
That's true. That's definitely true. They also were, at the same time, when they first married, they built out a fabulous apartment, a condo, in a historic building on Lakeshore Drive in Chicago. And I'm sure it was the same thing, that people were so flummoxed by this, that hamburgers had made this man so rich. It's really hard to overstate just how popular Ray Kroc was in his day for having made such a fortune because of something seen as so pedestrian. But it was an example of a great Horatio Alger story. And all the people who worked with him to propagate these McDonald's did well, too. So it was the American dream.
And then Ray, who dictates how every inch of a McDonald's should look and be maintained, does the same for his wife. So she has to have her hair kind of clamped into a sort of helmet head of of hairspray and so on.
Always very elegantly appointed. She was 26 years younger, so she had to look good. But to her credit, it turned out that being the sort of classic trophy wife was not enough for her.
So to bring us right back to where our story starts, having given us that picture, it's even more kind of odd that she's the person behind Chain Reaction.
Such a feminist, such an activist, not somebody you would equate with a wealthy spouse of a conservative company. And McDonald's was such a conservative company. And most of the people in power, all of the people in power were men. And so here was Joan, who was annoyed with the chauvinism of McDonald's. And yet she flourished as this almost post-hippie, post-feminist philanthropist, because she looks like somebody who's going out and being a lady who lunches. But really what she was doing was very radical, especially given her station in life and the time in which she lived.
It's a great story, Lisa. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Napoli's new book is Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. And you know you want to see over-the-top photos of the J&R Double Arch Ranch with its shag carpeting and gaudy floral wallpaper. Well, we have images from that 1968 spread in Architectural Digest. See it at kcrw.com/DNAblog. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Jackie Liu. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.